Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday, the 5th of September. Very nice to have you with us. It is a nice day, a fall, late summer, pre-fall day, and seems to be very nice. And we hope that you will enjoy it. We hope that you'll enjoy the weekend, and we hope you'll enjoy our time together this morning. We have a lot going on. We'll get to it. I want to introduce our group to you. A couple of things I would like to mention just in the housekeeping department to bring you up to date. First of all, tonight at 7:30, I'm looking at Sienna, but I'll look at all of you. But the Jay Giles Band.
Sure.
Yeah. Freeze Frame.
Centerfold.
Centerfold. Right. Peter Wolf. The man who made his mark as the lead singer of the Jay Giles Band will be in conversation with me tonight at UAlbany, the Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Creative Life series. We do a couple of these a year, several of these, two, I believe, a semester, I think is how it works out. And our first is tonight, September 5th. 7:30 in the main theater at UAlbany Performing Arts Center. And all you have to do is go to nyswritersinstitute.org for more information. The events are free, which is very cool. But we would, if you want to find out more information, that's all you have to do. Peter and I will be talking about his new book, Waiting on the Moon, Artists, Poets, Drifters, Grifters, and Goddesses.
In that order.
It is a memoir. And Peter Wolf. Peter Wolf will be with us tonight at 7:30. I hope you can enjoy and join us tonight for that event. Then, let's see. Then I go to Lake Placid. We're all going to Lake Placid. WAMC on the road. We're all going to Lake Placid on Monday. We're doing the show from Lake Placid. It's our Adirondack Roundtable Trade and Tourism in the Park. It's Monday, September 8th, from 9 to noon at the High Peaks Resort in Lake Placid, New York.
So jealous. I'm so jealous.
Well, especially in these early tinges of fall,
yeah,
how beautiful to be in the Adirondacks and to be there. We're joining up with our friends from North Country Public Radio, which is very exciting. NCPR's Emily Russell and Kara Chapman, alongside myself and our group, will dig into the demographic and livelihood challenges facing Adirondackers. We're going to talk about tariffs. We're going to talk about the changing demographics of the Adirondack Park. And we do welcome a live audience. The way this is going to work, our show, meaning the roundtable as a whole, goes from 9 to noon. We're going to be doing a simulcast with North Country Public Radio from 10 to noon. So we'll have our show that'll just broadcast to our audience from 9 to 10, and then we'll start the simulcast with our NCPR friends from 10 until 12. You can be a part of the whole dang thing by just going to our website, WAMC.org, or their website, NCPR.org, and register WAMC.org/WAMC on the road. So that'll be Monday. The next time you hear us and hear this introduction to this program, we will be in the 6 million acre Adirondack Park. So,
hey, could you do a little bit of homework for me while you're up in Lake Placid?
Sure.
I understand that you can actually take a ride on the bobsled run from the Olympics.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah, I've done it. Yeah.
That is a bucket list item
for me.
That's
fun.
You've done it.
Yeah.
You've done it.
Yeah, I've done it.
Oh.
That's Heather. I've done it.
Yeah, you can also skate on the Olympic speed skating oval. I mean, there's
not as much of an adrenaline rush.
Oh, it is.
Seriously?
Go as fast as you can. You can rent speed skating skates too.
Not that fast for me.
Now, are you on the when you're on the bobsled? Are you on alone?
Oh. No, I went on with another person.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And does that person know what they're doing?
The other person
she's here,
was the
right?
person I was there with.
Oh, okay. All right.
Like, no, we didn't know what we were doing.
Okay,
no,
all right.
They kind
okay.
of just tell you, you know, don't
let
die.
You go.
Do you sign a liability waiver?
They just give you a push and off and go?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Well, I mean, there's, you know, you wear a helmet.
There's
the helmet.
Seatbelt,
oh,
yeah. You know?
I am not reassured. So,
but
I'm going to
yeah,
do it.
Yeah, it's really cool. I did a long time ago. It was a lot of fun.
Got it.
Now, you know, maybe they've clamped down on how freewheeling they are about it, but it was a lot of fun when I did it.
Yeah.
All right. I have a question, which has nothing to do. It only has to do with, like, these excursion type things of you know, extracurricular activities that you can do when you're on vacation. So we're planning a trip to Hawaii.
Oh, and I've been like so many times.
And I got the excursion brochure the other day, and the only thing I was really interested in was going into the cage and being lifted down and seeing the sharks. And that looks so cool.
Yeah.
Relatively safe?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, way more fun and also more dangerous. It's like do the helicopter rides or Road to Hana on Maui. I mean, there's...
Oh, well, we'll do Road to Hana.
Yeah.
But
that's a big deal. If you're renting a car, it is some hardcore driving.
Yeah, seriously. I don't think we'll do that.
You should do it.
We can't skate over the fact that Joe just said he wanted to be placed in a cage.
With sharks.
And be among the sharks.
They're feeding the sharks stuff outside the cage, so you don't look that...
They say they don't chum. Is that BS?
Well, maybe this one that you're going on doesn't chum.
Yeah.
No, they don't want to get them into a feeding frenzy, so it's probably not a good idea.
I don't
idea
want them to be in a beach.
Yeah,
crazy.
Yeah.
How much closer do you need to be to sharks?
I don't know. I've got this Jaws thing going. It's the 50th anniversary. Yeah, I want to celebrate in its entirety. But I have to say that ever since several years ago when we went on family vacation and I was attacked by a stingray, and we were in the, you know, this like little fun pet the stingray thing, and they said it was safe, and then I did it, and the guy from the place comes over and he said, oh, it's just a little love. They do love kisses. They just do little love kisses. And then he looked at my leg and goes, Jesus Christ. And the next thing I know, I was being in an ambulance, being whirled down to this health center.
Wow.
Yeah. But
so you want to get bit by more marine?
No, I don't. I don't want to get bit, but I'm fascinated by it. I think it sounds very cool.
Well, have you ever scuba dived?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, scuba diving, they tell you, and snorkeling too. Oh, if you see just punch it in the nose.
Oh, sure.
Oh, yeah.
No biggie.
Yeah. They're usually not. I mean, I've been snorkeling where there are sharks around, close, but they're not. They were not big.
But
they were like, you know.
Yeah.
They would be a big fish if you caught them.
Joe has confessed to a Jaws fascination. You know how both the book and the movie end, right?
Yeah. Hooper, I just saw it in IMAX, actually.
Yeah, Hooper dies in the book because the shark breaks into his cage. He swims away in the movie.
Yes.
And you still want to do it.
He does. Well, the other thing, too, is it seems to be a group activity. Like the cage.
A buffet.
The cage.
You stay in the middle of the cage and let everybody else be on the outside.
Yeah, look around. I think it sounds fun.
All right.
It
sounds like a good time.
Okay.
I'll stick to the bobsled.
By the way, if you want to do.
Don't be the slowest one, right?
If you want to come up and join us and go bobsledding to get ready for your shark adventure, we'd love for you to do that. It's a Monday on September 8th. And I don't know. Can you? Is that a year-round thing you can do?
No, it wasn't. It didn't used to be. There had to be snow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I mean,
well, you need that ingredient.
But I don't know, you know, the degree to which, like I said, it was a long time ago. It was like 1980-something.
So. Well, excitement abounds. So we'll be at the Adirondack Roundtable event Monday, September 8th at 9 o'clock. And that'll be a lot of fun. If you haven't experienced doing the shark thing, let me know. I'd love to hear about it. I'm curious. My family is just baffled by why I want to do this, but I am curious.
Letters at sharkbait.wm.
No.
Yeah.
No, I'm very excited.
It's really cool.
Yeah, you know, we're looking forward to it. It should be a lot of fun. All right, I think I have all of the important stuff out of the way, except for because there's nothing more important than my shark story. I think I have all the important stuff out of the way, except for, of course, introducing our panelists. Let me do that now. You've heard their voices, but let me introduce them to you officially. Sienna Freeman Tolbert is here, partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Hello, Sienna. How are you?
I am good and still baffled by your shark and conversation. I'm coming down from that.
Yeah, well, me too. And we also welcome senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pendicio is here. Hello, Robert.
Hello,
how are you?
Joe, and happy fall.
Yes, happy fall indeed. And we welcome CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan. Hello, Heather.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right. Let's get started with the day's news. Yesterday, there was a hearing. You may have heard about it. And it took place in Washington. And all eyes were on Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the CDC as the Health and Human Services Secretary defended his tenure before the Senate Finance Committee. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on Thursday defended his handling of vaccines, including updated coronavirus shots and the ouster of the director of Centers for Disease Control and Prevention during a roughly three-hour Senate hearing. It was a little raucous. The hearing provided the first opportunity in months for lawmakers to grill Kennedy, who has emerged as one of the most polarizing officials in the Trump administration, with Democratic lawmakers and medical organizations calling for his firing. Even some Republicans, including the second highest ranking GOP senator, expressed frustration at Kennedy for challenging long-standing vaccine policies. In his opening statement before the Senate Finance Committee, Kennedy touted, quote, the busiest, most proactive administration in HHS history. He cited the agency's moves on pushing companies to eliminate artificial food dyes, addressing drug prices, and fighting fraud in healthcare, among many other moves. White House officials praised Kennedy's performance. On X, Vice President J.D. Vance ripped Democrats for lecturing the secretary, while White House press secretary said the administration is, quote, addressing root causes of chronic disease, embracing transparency in government, and championing gold standard science. Only the Democrats could attack that common sense effort. Kennedy's testimony unfolded more than a week after the White House fired CDC Director Susan Meneses, prompting three senior officials to resign in protest and roiling the agency tasked with protecting the nation's public health. So during the hearing, Senators Ron Wyden and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, Ron Wyden from Oregon, pressed Kennedy on Meneses, who had just been confirmed in July, in an op-ed published Thursday in the Wall Street Journal. Meneses wrote that she was pressured to fire senior staff and, quote, pre-approve the recommendations of a vaccine advisory panel newly filled with people who have publicly expressed anti-vaccine rhetoric. With that information, we will begin. Heather.
I watched part of the hearing, and honestly, after a while, it would just give you a headache because it was just, you know, red meat. And honestly, it seemed like there was a little bit of bipartisan dissatisfaction with him. I think in particular, and I'm blanking out on the guy's name, who is a physician who was very
Kennedy. Senator Kennedy. Senator.
Yeah, no, not
Cassidy.
Cassidy, yes.
Yeah, I was listening to him, and, you know, he was sort of trying to say, like, well, did you actually tell me the truth? It was a little unsettling. As an aside, reminds me, I just finished reading a book, which was amazing, called I Cheerfully Refuse. And it describes an alternate world, an alternate U.S., where no one reads anything anymore and no one believes scientists. And you have an extremely divided set of classes.
Wait, that's an alternate how?
I know. It's really good. It's a really good book.
It used to be in the fiction section.
But I mean, Robert Kennedy would fit right in this. It's, you know, it's got a little bit of like 1982 flavor to it. George Orwell, you know, it's sort of, he appeared to just blatantly lie multiple times. And at the beginning of the hearing where they were trying to make him be sworn in, which you don't do with cabinet members, apparently, out of courtesy, one of the panelists asked that he be required to take an oath and be sworn in, and they did not require it, which I think is funny. So I guess he was just free to make up whatever he wanted. It seemed like he was making stuff up.
I mean, it was chaotic at his best. I mean, I thought that just day to day as a mom, this felt very timely, you know, because what we're doing right now is trying to schedule flu shots, right? And we're trying to schedule the COVID booster, and you're not able to get it. And you're figuring out how you can get this for your kids.
Have you really had trouble
yes,
getting it?
Yes,
because
so
I'm getting notices like every day. Come get it. Come get it.
No, if you go on to, you know, the CVS and you schedule a flu shot, you try to schedule a COVID booster, if you say, no, I don't have any kind of comorbidities or any kind of health condition, you're not getting it.
Huh.
And they're saying, go to your doctor. And so now you have to go to your doctor's. All these extra steps you have to go through just to get a booster that you're choosing to get.
Maybe,
you know?
Just because I'm old. That's why I'm getting it. I'm the front of the line because I'm old.
And since the COVID, it hasn't been hard to get. We go as a family. We get all of our vaccines. It's just so easy to make these decisions as a family now, whether you want to do it or not, right? And so it's just very frustrating. I thought it was very timely to see this conversation on the news. I know they did it, obviously, because of what's happening. But I think this is what's happening in a lot of homes. A lot of conversations are happening in a lot of people's homes. The start of schools. So we're getting vaccinations again. Here we are, and this conversation is happening. So I thought it was just a good, I don't know, it's good timing because it's back to school. We're dealing with that. But then, you know, the legal perspective, I'm thinking, okay, so what comes from this? What comes from this chaos? What happens next? As we know, not much. Until they make a ruling, the CDC makes a ruling, and then the courts can finally step in if it's not science-backed. Because these agencies, I think they say, the science-based agencies must ground their decision in evidence, not preference. And so I think that's when we'll actually be able to bring some litigation once they start making these actual recommendations. Then we can make the argument that it's not science-backed and it's just a preference. So that's going to be the more interesting litigation that we're going to see around this. But this hearing, I think, is just timely because it's what's happening around the country. And also, what's a big conversation among the moms is also we're watching the measles outbreak and we're watching this.
Yeah.
Like the schools are where it spreads, right? The schools are where it happens. And I think that's what we're seeing happening right now.
I'm kind of with you, Heather. I found the entire spectacle to be just depressing.
Yeah.
I've previously on the roundtable lamented the politicization of public health and the CDC, and there it was, you know, in all its glory for 3 hours, you know, yesterday. It devolved into theater. The one time that Kennedy drew blood was when he, accused Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, of taking, what, $855,000 in pharmaceutical contributions. And then, bizarrely, Bernie Sanders jumped in ostensibly to defend her and then said, called it an insult and said nearly every politician takes pharma dollars.
So it's okay.
As if that normalizes, yeah. Right? Rather than highlighting the
we all do
rot.
It.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We all lie about where we live. We get mortgages. Of course,
right,
you know?
Of course. Like, who hasn't taken pharma dollars? It was just... I'm a Mets fan, so I was reminded of the 1996 World Series between the New York Yankees and the Atlanta Braves, and lamenting that how sad that one of these two had to win, and that's what that's what it felt like.
Sorry,
watching
I'm
this
a
yesterday.
Yankees fan, so.
but look, more seriously, it just underscored what I talked about last week when I was on the roundtable. Like this serves no one to have this incredible politicization. I shouldn't use this word because I can't say it. Of public health and the CDC. Nobody's winning from this.
I mean, the most confusing part for me was, okay, so where does the Trump administration stand on this? Like, where do they land on this issue in terms of what we see is this bipartisan Senate committee questioning him, and then you go back to the White House. What does the White House say about this? They support him, but then we hear in the news that they're questioning this, questioning RFK. So I'm just like, where are we? Where, what is, you know, I just felt very, and then you had the senators, the Republican senators that question him coming out afterwards with statements saying, we still support, you know, whatever
right.
the White House well, does. Yeah.
Well, he was asked, do you believe that President Trump deserves a Nobel Prize
yes.
for Operation whatever
Warp Speed.
Warp Speed, yeah. Yeah. And it was so funny because Kennedy was like, well, yes. And that was the you know, getting the vaccine to market as quickly. I mean, people forget that was Trump that did the program to get yeah. the vaccines
right.
developed more rapidly to basically incentivize the pharmaceutical companies, which was a good thing. I mean, we can people may dislike him, but that doesn't mean he's not capable of occasionally doing something good. And that was a good thing that he did. But it was funny because he's asked the question, does he deserve the Nobel Prize for it? And Kennedy says, yes, well, of course he does. I'm like, dude, you're just so confused.
Because he
you're
did all saying. The stuff that I'm saying you shouldn't do.
Yeah, right.
The thing that struck me, and Captain Obvious here, but it just did strike me that for a department that has been portrayed, whether fairly or not, has been portrayed as just being in chaos,
mm-hmm.
in utter tumult, there was really nothing on display yesterday, at least from my eyes, that where I sat back and said, oh, they got this under control. Yeah. Like, oh, all right.
But
everything seems to be good here.
But, Joe, that's precisely my point. In other
yeah.
words, and we talked about this last time. I don't have the data in front of me, but public trust in public health and the CDC in general has cratered since COVID. This doesn't help. And a responsible, not just a responsible administration, a responsible government, both parties, would recognize that this is a crisis, you know, that we cannot have a country in which public health is perpetually under a cloud and used as a political football. There will be a price to pay for that in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you go back, like even 80s, 90s, there's all these movies about Outbreak
sure.
and, you know, all the crazy kind of really super scary
yeah.
world pandemic kind of movies.
The Hot Zone.
Yeah, Hot yeah, Zone is yeah. one of them. In all of them, you do get an illustration, and obviously I think this is something that actually happens, of disagreement within the CDC.
Yeah.
In all of those movies, there's one scientist, you know, who's really the bold guy who's like, no, what we need to do is this, and all the bureaucrats in CDC are saying, no, we need to stay the course.
Yeah.
And, you know, so you always get that like subtext of conflict inside of the CDC. I think that's been around for a long time. I think the biggest difference is since COVID, you know, the measures that were put in place were so basically divisive, depending on
mm-hmm.
where you were,
yeah. mm-hmm.
that it completely undermined any pre-existing like deference to science.
No question.
Yeah.
Look
and,
at the school closures alone. I mean,
yeah,
25 years of academic gains vaporized.
And by the way, like the post analysis of that was that they were wrong about that.
Absolutely.
That
yeah,
it caused more harm than good, but
no
that
question.
Vaccines were good. So
yeah.
it's not a clean slate, right? You're not walking into this pristine agency to begin with.
That's
right?
Fair.
Yeah.
No, absolutely fair. And look, you know, Kennedy,
putting a nut job in charge, by the way, doesn't help.
Wasn't a good move.
Yeah,
let's,
right?
let's call it what it is. But he also didn't invent vaccine skepticism.
Right.
I mean, that's been kind of, you know, so woven into the fabric for a while now. My simplistic point is we need to start to take seriously rebuilding trust in public
yeah.
health, not continuing to use it for you know performative theatrical displays
yeah,
like we saw
how
yesterday.
How do you do that?
I was gonna say, but that speaks to like the whole, what's the Republican position on this? Because that vaccine skepticism was usually seen as something, and someone just reminded me on news I was watching this morning, that was seen as something very progressive, very
yes.
you know liberal, right? We had. You know, now all of a sudden it's what they say, make America healthy again, right?
Uh-huh.
Michelle Obama was doing that and it was criticized,
yep.
right? And so I'm just trying to figure it all out.
Yep.
You know, President Trump was eating McDonald's during his last administration in the White House. I mean, that doesn't, like, so we're just trying to figure out where people stand, and I find it so confusing as a layperson.
Yeah.
It must be confusing as a layperson trying to vote on these issues and understand what's happening and trying to understand what is the message coming from the administration, because it shoots both ways.
All right. Well, I don't think it's partisan. I think that's the thing. I think you've got people on both sides.
Treating it like a football.
Yeah.
No mm-hmm. question.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole thing of these key people within weaving the fact we've been talking about aspects of this all week of what many states are just saying, all right, we got nothing from you. We're going out on our own. We're figuring this out by ourselves because you're not helping at all. And then, I mean, we've mentioned it. Sort of in the ether, but not directly, but this complete rejection of actual science that seems to be going on. You're wincing.
Well, I'm wincing because we are lying in the bed that we made. We had, let's be frank, the politicization of science during COVID. So, you know, it's hard to come back from that.
But don't you think, okay, agreed, but are not, I think I agree, are there not the let's just say, the three who are leaving and are within that department of saying, we do not feel that the guidance that has been given is the best guidance and is scientifically driven for the people of the United States?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. Let me answer it with a question. You know, I used to know who were the most trusted authorities in science in this country, and I just don't know who they are anymore. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when we read about Jonas Salk, you know,
yeah.
and the polio vaccine, and he was a genuine American hero. Watson and Crick, you know, the DNA research, I remember, you know, they were held in high regard. I simply don't know who are who has the gravitas in the scientific community to really kind of take a lead here.
But well, isn't
I was going to say, well, he said a month ago that CDC director Susan Manares was unimpeachable.
Yeah, okay.
He said that
but
she was the leader.
You have to, and
but I mean,
I don't want to sound cynical. I don't want to sound cynical, but you know, the word of politicians about who are scientific authorities is not where this conversation starts. It's probably closer to where it ends.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with you, Robert. I just, in the sense of you're right. Who are these bastions of great scientific thought?
Yeah.
But I don't know that they can exist in this because of what you mentioned
point.
For the politicization of the of what's going on. I mean, you look at Anthony Fauci's record and what he achieved over his time. And certainly with the AIDS crisis and other aspects of his career, I think you could make the case. But then you put him into that,
yeah.
and it gets struck. And I think there were a lot of people that fell into that. And to the point, once you've seen people go into, oh, what analogy will I use? A shark cage. like, how willing are you to then jump in the water and say, okay, I'm gonna stand up and do this?
You know, and actually, let me expand the lens beyond just public health. And again, I'm betraying my age here, but I'm old enough to have grown up in the era where science was, you know, just an American point of pride. We just put men on the moon. Vaccines, et cetera. You know, I kind of got this idea as a kid that, you know, science was a uniquely American gift or talent or strong suit for us. And, you know, and we work in education, you know, so much emphasis. We didn't call it STEM at the time, but there was a big national move, you know, post-Sputnik, that we were going to be, you know, really emphasize science in school. And somehow, it's funny, I hadn't thought about this until this very moment, Joe. Where'd that go? You know, this is no longer viewed, I think. It should be. We've got a robust tech industry and whatnot. But maybe where this starts is back in the schools. Okay, I'm being that guy in education to, you know, to a hammer, everything's a nail. But we have to start to rebuild our trust in science, our trust in public health, our scientific infrastructure, and, yeah, science education.
And it doesn't help that they defunded all of those grants about what's the mRNA funding and things like that. So that's all very concerning on what's happening and where we stand in the world as a whole. You know, we're seeing it in immigration. We're not seeing as many people coming to study at institutions. They rather study somewhere else. There's no research funding. We're seeing complaints about the ability to get research funding, especially in controversial areas like climate change and things like that. And this is one of the issues that we're having, and it's going to affect us in the long term.
Yeah. It should be a point of pride, and it's become like everything else. It's under a political cloud.
I wonder, like, with the super scientists, right? The ones in who are the rock stars, and you were talking about, you know, who would be a credible voice on this. I think the problem is as soon as someone becomes a voice on it, in the culture that we're in, they immediately become
a suspect, a target. You're right.
You know, and you look at what happened during the pandemic. You had some people who got glorified and then taken down. And even in sports, I think, I forget what movie it is, but it's the one about Nike. At one point the comment is made, just, you know, be aware. Once you get to the top, the first thing that will happen is everyone will try and chip away and find what your flaw is. And that's a problem in our culture, is that we can't just accept that people are complex human beings and nobody's perfect, but you can be really good at science and not great at other things doesn't mean that you're not good at science.
Yeah. Right? And just quickly to underscore that, and when you have a DOJ that is not independent enough, you automatically, if you put your head out there to be a leader and to go against this, you may have potential criminal charges brought against you. You may have an investigation done. They're starting to comb through things. And that's a problem if you speak out. So you have to be ready to face potential criminal charges or investigations.
That's why I think there's great, great harm to be done in any kind of politically motivated, selective prosecution. And by the way, I mean, that is what happened with Trump, right? They did go after him on things that, inflating your insurance value of real estate. I mean, that's not something that people had gone. That was pursued by a Democratic administration. And he turned around. And he's like, oh, okay, well, I'm coming after you now. And it's going to be something equally as, you know, not something that has been prosecuted before, not something that DOJ has focused on before, but, you know, it's I know you are, but what am I? You start getting into that, and I'm sorry, that's a reference I make all the time, and I always wonder if people know what I'm talking about. You know, schoolyard, right?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. No. Well.
Yeah. The Pee Wee Herman class of I Know You Are, But What Am I?
Yeah.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have a lot of letters on this. Surprise! We'll go to those letters and continue the conversation after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Very nice to have you with us. 49 minutes past 9 o'clock on this Friday morning. Let's go to letters. And we go to Raina, who writes to us and says, Trump is attempting to peel off Democratic voters issue by issue, whether it's vaccine, crime, the war on drugs, or trans rights. Chaos and confusion make it hard to message a coherent response to any or all of it. Democrats need to be focused and speak with clarity of their vision for our country moving forward. That and fight like hell, perfectly using many expletives. All right. If that seems to be an ingredient, then we'll see it. Yesterday, my husband and I had appointments to get the COVID vaccine, writes Kim. Before you can get them, you have to have a prescription specific to the exact vaccine you want. We did not have the correct one. You have to know the specific one that the pharmacy has. We could not get it. Another pharmacy says due to New York State regulations, they can schedule it. After many phone calls, we now have to ask our doctor to send this particular vaccine to the pharmacy. They call to make an appointment. It's not as easy as RFK makes it sound. We are in our 70s are in having a very, very difficult time getting scheduled.
This is exactly what I've been hearing about, people having to go to different states to try to get it. It's frustrating.
I don't understand why it would have to be a different state. But Hochul signing an executive order on Friday, according to today's reporting.
So today.
That, yeah. Oh, yeah. Today is Friday, isn't it?
It's that Monday holiday.
That will allow pharmacies to actually do the prescriptions for the vaccines, which is good. You know, so that'll hopefully speed things up.
Leslie writes, people in Florida celebrating the end of vaccine mandates may not be considering the fact that reputable and competent doctors will no longer want to practice in such a state. Of course, Florida known for its reputable and competent doctors. Then we go to Janet. Bernie has only taken small dollar donations from pharmaceutical companies, and his point was that RFK Jr. singled out Senator Warren when many, many senators receive large donations from Big Pharma.
I understood his point with crystalline clarity.
Let's see. We go to Liz. I disagree with the comment that the CDC did not handle the pandemic adequately. Science is a process. The pandemic was frightening. Scientists were doing the very best they could as more and more discoveries about the virus became understood. And the vaccine saved millions of lives. Skepticism about science when ideas change is an indication that you don't understand science.
Ooh, can I respond to that?
Yes,
you sure can.
I would like to also.
Okay, yeah, because we actually talked this on the roundtable not that long ago. Who wrote the guidance for reopening schools? It was not scientists. It was Randy Weingarten, you know, the director of the second largest teachers union. I made this point previously as well about, you know, during the summer of George Floyd, where we had to have social distancing and we couldn't gather in, you know, groups of more than 10 or more, even in our backyard. Well, suddenly there was a public health menace with racism and it was okay to go to a protest. So as much as I lament the politicization of science, it's you have to also be fair and notice that sometimes science politicizes itself.
Yeah. And sometimes they get it wrong.
Sure.
And
we have to give grace, no question.
Right. And I am a big believer, like, you get something wrong, you fix it, you move forward, but you got to own it.
That's right.
And I don't think that it has been owned. I don't think that there has been an acknowledgement by any of the folks who made these decisions that what the decision they made was wrong. And in fact, there was a group of scientists who strongly objected to the school closures, to basically the closures of business, saying that there's no evidence, A, that this will control it, none, actually, historical, and it will cause more socioeconomic harm than any potential good that it will bring. And they were marginalized.
We absolutely knew by the fall of 2020 that children were not a vector for this.
Right.
And in fact, I have a dear friend, Payman Rahanifard, who is on the State Board of Education in Massachusetts, who made this case quite compellingly and to no good end.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I hear what everyone's saying, and I know, you know, hindsight is 20/20 and all of this, but I do recall what was happening during that time and watching all those people die and watching all those people. It was tragic, and it was something that I only experienced once in my lifetime like this. And I think there must be some grace given because
no
we were all trying to figure it out. And no one knew the right answer. We were all trying to decide. I remember that fall, we were trying to decide whether to put the kids back in school or not. And you were getting all this information from everywhere saying different things. And so it was a hard time for everybody amongst all those lives being lost.
I agree with both of you. Absolutely, we need to give grace for what was a fluid situation. But there should be some acknowledgement in retrospect that, hey, we got it wrong.
Yeah, exactly. Agreed.
Yep.
All right, let's go to this letter from Russ. Now that COVID inoculations are available to a relatively small sliver of the population, it seems to me that someone should have asked Mr. Kennedy whether he had models predicting the increase in COVID cases and resulting mortality. But it seems all the questions were about the seating in the cabinet clown car. That from Russ. Then we go to, I think, yes, that's a copy on the other letter. Here we go. Thea, thanks. So thankful I live in Massachusetts. Maura Healey announced that there will be no age restrictions for COVID vaccines in the state, and more importantly, that Massachusetts health insurance companies will be required to pay for them. From Scott we go, and to Scott we go. As Joe said, Captain Obvious here. The Trump administration's actions have been anti-science, anti-justice, anti-art, anti-economic, and anti-humane. Donzilla has really wrecked everything, accounting to plan, a.k.a. Project 25. What will it take to put us back on track? Make intelligent decisions, American society, otherwise known as Midas. That from Scott, who worked on that. That's good. John said, we have suffered years of scientists claiming smoking cigarettes was not the cause of lung cancer and that burning fossil fuel was not the cause of global warming. Why should we believe any scientists after years of bought and paid for science? I mean, I think that does go to the, you can find, I mean, certainly in the legal profession, I mean, you can find pretty much
Hey.
I'm a lawyer too, so it's okay.
No.
I stand with you.
No lawyer jokes on Friday.
No lawyer joke Friday. No, the point I was going to make is that I think you would agree with this, is that it is not unheard of to find an expert that is able to articulate the view that you would like to share with the jury.
Everybody deserves due process is what we prefer, but yes.
Yes, okay. All right. And that, exactly. Thank you for your discussion on vaccines, et cetera. As a retired physician and a person old enough to remember kids getting polio and being paralyzed, I find the current situation truly sad. It's interesting to me to hear you guys discuss, since you are younger and not medical professionals. There is a distinction to be made between basic science and public health. Restoring public confidence will require public health folk to communicate effectively and respectfully. Back when the pandemic was young, I was careful to be respectful to patients, friends, and family who asked questions about vaccines, about ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, and so on. I cringe when commentators scoffed at horse dewormer. Sigh. Says Anita.
You know what the first step to restoring public confidence in public health is? Wanting to.
Yeah. I actually have ivermectin. I'm not going to give out my address, though, in case anyone, you know.
But you have horses.
Yes, it's for the horses. It's not for me.
I just think it's key to put that part of the story.
But there was a run on it. Like, for a while, I'd go to Agway to get my ivermectin for my horses, and you couldn't get it. And I'm like, who's buying all the... I mean, it's you know, it's apple-flavored paste.
I learned so much interesting things on the table.
Apple-flavored paste. Put that on a wheat thin. Let's see. One more letter. We go to Kathy. I was the director of public health in a small city in Massachusetts during COVID, and we couldn't keep the schools open because so many teachers were out sick with the virus, and there was no one to run the classrooms. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will switch topics and discuss other stuff upon our return. In the meantime, a few announcements and news with Ray Graff. Music of Yasmin Williams being played this morning as our bumper music, and you can see all of the tracks listed online at wamc.org/roundtable. We have the playlist posted there. Again, Yasmin Williams and the playlist posted at wamc.org. Welcome back to the program. 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. Let me remind you who is making up our panel this morning. Partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pendicio, and CEO of Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, all join us, and we welcome you as well. panel@wamc.org. So we'll go to this one. I don't think it'll take long, but here we go. The President Trump will sign an executive order this morning renaming the Department of Defense the Department of War. It is fulfilling the president's pledge to realign the mission of the armed forces by reverting to a name used for over 150 years until shortly after World War II. The measure, which has been expected for some time, underscores Mr. Trump's efforts to reshape the military to align with his goals of projecting a more aggressive image by showcasing war fighting and the capabilities of soldiers, as Mr. Trump has sought to show strength rather than the, quote, wokeness that he and Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth claim clouded the military's morale and mission under former President Biden. He has often referred back to the country's dominant role in global conflicts and complained that it has not been celebrated enough. Mr. Trump plans to sign the executive order again today. It was first reported by Fox News. He floated the idea in August in the Oval Office, saying that it sounded like a better name and that he believed we're going to have to go back to that. He said the name change would be a reminder to the country's record of military victories under the old name, citing World War I and World War II. We had an unbelievable history of victory when it was Department of War. Defense is too defensive, and we want to be defensive, but we want to be offensive too, if we have to be. The month before Mr. Trump floated the idea, he referred to Mr. Hegseth as his Secretary of War.
Oh boy. I know the rules of the game. Trump does something, therefore we're supposed to, you know, react with indignation and outrage. It's a news cycle.
Only if necessary. Yeah. Only if warranted.
I can't do it. I'm sorry. I'm having a difficult time mustering indignation for this. And look, frankly, I kind of like it, if I'm honest. But on the other hand, I'm also the guy who insists on calling it the Triborough Bridge and then the Pan Am Building and Sixth Avenue. So I'm all about old school names. Look, my only advice for President Trump here is to double down on this. If you're going to have an executive order that renames the Department of Defense, the Department of War, then I also want an executive order that requires Pete Hegseth to grow an Edwin Stanton beard, like Lincoln's Secretary of War, perhaps the most famous one in American history. Then we're good.
I think it's funny, honestly. The first thing that I can think of is like, oh, if we're gonna do that, why not like Department of Massive Military Might, or the world's greatest military, you know, Department of, you know, safety for the planet. I don't know, but it just makes me think of this old
undefeated World War champion.
Yeah. Yeah, right. That's a good one, right?
Masters of the domain.
We should get giant belts. You know,
right?
But it just makes me think of there was an old Saturday Night Live, and it was I'm gonna totally screw this up, but Antonio Banderas was in it, okay. And it was Quien es más macho.
Quien es más macho? I remember that.
And I'm like, yeah, that's what it makes me think of. But I don't think it's that big a deal.
I do think
like if you make a mountain out of every molehill, if you decide that every decision is so insanely wrong that we all are, you know, need to like have our hair on fire and start talking about impeachment, then you lose credibility. It used to be the Department of War, changing the name back. You know, Pete Hegseth put out a very scientific X. Not Twitter. It used to be Twitter. Now it's X.
No, but since I call it the Pan Am Building, and
we're
going to
go with Twitter then. Okay,
that's right.
Well, he polled it, and I'm sure that he has a very bipartisan, you know, group of followers. But in that group, 54% to 46 said yes, it should be changed. I was a little surprised that it was 46 who said no, but whatever.
I look forward to the South Park episode.
Team
America, you know exactly what I'm referring to.
They're going
to
nail it too. I'm sure.
Well,
Sienna.
Well,
go ahead. Bring us back to seriousness.
Yeah, I will say the Department of War, I could care less, but I think it is symbolic in nature because I think I was looking into, I read it and I was looking further, and then I thought about other stuff about how the Department of Defense was named based on the National Security Act of 1947, I saw. And this all reminded me of the change from the INS, Immigration and National Service, to the Department of Homeland Security when they did that, right? And how important names can be. I mean, in this situation, yeah, it's kind of fun and gay. It doesn't matter. It's very symbolic. But I think when we think about what happened with the restructuring of immigration from the Immigration and Nationalization Services to the Department of Homeland Security, which branched out into the Citizen Benefit Services, and it branched out into ICE, and it branched out into this other, that was a reorganization after 9/11 that was showed that they were changing their position and priorities when it came to immigration, yep. Right? And so, you know, on one hand, yes, I get it. We can, you know, chuckle about it. But on the other hand, I'm like, okay, what does that say about the priorities of the administration? And we know what they are. It's very clear what they are. But it's just interesting to me, and that's what it harkens back to. And I wonder, is it even official? It seems like an executive order that really, you know, they can change names, but also the cost. Can we talk about the cost? This man is expensive because now we have to go through back and rebrand everything for as the DOD.
New letterhead.
He is so expensive. Talk about high maintenance. I mean, every time he does something, I'm like, how much does it cost?
Yeah.
How much does this cost?
But it is, you know, and it's different, of course, but because it doesn't have a precedent. But the Gulf of America, and you think, yes. Okay, so this is something that is interesting to discuss and look at. So we have the Department of War. I think I agree with all of you that I really don't care.
Why are you making us talk about it, Joe?
No, I really don't care. But what I do, I'm much more worried about what is going on at whatever the name of that department is.
Sure.
Like, I'm much more concerned about what is happening within the walls.
Yeah.
And as we talk about this, I hope it doesn't overshadow that, because obviously that is much more important.
Yeah. Let's focus on streamlining defense. Let's focus on countering China. Let's keep our eyes on geopolitical and budgetary battles. This is a nothing burger.
But being being born in the 1960s, I must say that I do just, you know, I would much rather talk about, yes, I would much rather talk about peace. I would much rather talk about defense than offense.
And we understand, you mentioned the National Security Act of 1947. Originally, after it was the Department of War, when they did the National Security Act, it was named the National Military Establishment. But they decided to rename it in 1949 to the Department of Defense because National Military Establishment, the letters are NME. And they're like, oh, that's enemy. So we don't like that.
Oh.
So,
okay.
Right?
It's all about marketing, folks.
Yeah. So it just makes you think, you know.
It does.
So this isn't this kind of...
So it was ridiculous then. It's ridiculous now.
We're all ridiculous.
Yeah. I'm going to read Barbara's letter because I think it's a great way to move on to the next subject. Barbara says simply, yeah, way to lobby for the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, right, exactly. yeah.
Or maybe it's the acknowledgement he's not going to get it.
All right, let's go to other stuff. I said we wouldn't spend long on it, and true to our word. Here we go. We... Now, this is it requires more thinking, I think. And that is, by ordering the U.S. military to summarily kill a group of people aboard what he said was a drug smuggling boat, President Trump used the military in a way that had no clear legal precedent or basis, according to specialists in the laws of war and executive power. Mr. Trump is claiming the power to shift maritime counter-drug efforts from law enforcement rules to wartime rules. The police arrest criminal suspects for prosecution and cannot instead simply gun suspects down, except in rare circumstances where they pose an imminent threat to someone. By contrast, in armed conflicts, troops can lawfully kill enemy combatants on sight. Because killing people is so extreme, and doing it without due process risks killing the wrong people by mistake, the question of which rules apply is not simply a matter of policy choice. Domestic and international law both set standards, constraining when presidents and nations can lawfully use wartime force. This from the coverage in the New York Times. After breaking new ground by labeling drug cartels as terrorists, the president is now redefining the peacetime criminal problem of drug trafficking as an armed conflict and telling the U.S. military to treat even suspected low-level drug smuggler, take two, and telling the U.S. military to treat even suspected low-level drug smugglers as combatants. But the trafficking of an illegal consumer product is not a capital offense, and Congress has not authorized armed conflict against cartels. That raises the question of whether Mr. Trump has legitimate authority to tell the military to summarily kill people it suspects are smuggling drugs, and whether the administration allowed career military lawyers to weigh in. A complicated issue, a real issue, and we discuss it this morning.
Yeah. I actually spent a little time trying to sort of disassemble the thought process here, because, you know, if it's okay, and I'm not saying that it's okay, but I guess if it's acceptable to kill someone because they're a terrorist, is that the same as killing someone who is engaged in a business that uses terrorist tactics? And I don't think it's the same thing. I am struggling with it. But you know, the cartels, I think, fairly routinely execute people and engage in behavior that is extremely violent and lawless. Terrorists operate in that same kind of thing. They also have an objective. Usually, it's not just to cause terror; it's to bring down a government or undermine, you know, people's confidence in their own government. And I, for whatever reason, I think it's different. I also think that it's not a declared war. I mean, I know there's air quotes war on drugs, and that goes back to Reagan, right?
Right.
Is that over?
Nancy.
I don't know if the war on drugs, I'm not sure if that was ever like officially declared over, but I think in order to use military force, you know, in an armed conflict that is in a war, is very different than using military force to just execute someone who's doing something illegal.
Yeah.
And whether it's on U.S. soil or not, I think there's an ethical problem. With that. It's different when someone is, you know, standing across the room from you pointing a semi-automatic weapon at you. You know, I just think it's different. But
yep, I agree. I mean, in fairness, or just to be balanced, the fentanyl epidemic is real and devastating. It kills over 100,000 Americans a year. You know, it fuels addiction and crime in our cities and whatnot. I would refer folks who are interested in this to read a really good article that was written by Andy McCarthy in National Review, the title of which was "Are We at War with Venezuela?" And he's a lawyer. So are you. I look forward to hearing your take on this as well.
We're two lawyers.
Yeah, I'm a lawyer.
Two lawyers.
Yeah, I'm not a good one, though. I'm a really good lawyer
here. But we're not formally at war. The Foreign Terrorist Organization declaration alone doesn't necessarily greenlight military strikes without, you know, Congress or stretching an imminent threat is really the issue here.
Right.
There was also a terrific post on X or Twitter, as I like to call it, from Jack Goldsmith, who is a Harvard-associated legal mind. And he raises the issue of whether, you know, Trump's foreign militarization could prop up the Alien Enemies Act, which he's tried to use, you know, for any number of domestic purposes. So what Goldsmith was warning was that the administration could use these strikes against the Venezuelan boat, for example, framing it as self-defense to argue that presidential determinations of what is or is not an imminent threat are beyond the court's reach.
Right.
So that may be what's going on here as well.
Yeah.
I mean, this is what we're seeing right now in our immigration world, unfortunately, is we're seeing that Alien Enemies Act being used to target people who they presume is suspected to be a member of this cartel, and so they can expedite the due process. So they can say we can do expedited removal for this individual because they're, you know, they are enemy as it is.
That's right.
And it's that imminent threat issue, and that's what's happening here. It's happening. What's happened, what we've been watching happening here in our country domestically, is exactly what happened again outside of our country here when he authorized this airstrike. This is exactly what's happening here. And what we're seeing is this use of the Article II powers. And then I think what we're seeing happening in California with the federalizing the National Guard, the use of a Title 10. I would think he's using Title 10 for that one. So we're seeing this stretching.
Yeah.
Of these executive powers and figuring out how far they can go. And the problem is that we have to wait for the court to put their arms back around and say, you can't go that far.
Yep.
And so they're going to continue to do this where they stretch and they see how far they can go with these Article II powers. And that's what we're seeing happening both in international waters and domestically. It's happening every day. And we're watching it every day. We're hearing about what's happening in Illinois, whether they're going to Chicago. And so I have never read so much about Article II powers.
Right.
I have never had to deal with Article II powers and all these wartime acts and whether or not it's applicable in an immigration posture, whether it's applicable in international waters. We keep seeing it. And I wonder, as they stretch these Article II powers to impact people in international waters, when will we see some global pushback from other countries? Because that's what's going to happen next.
But clearly there's a consistent pattern, you know, 8 months into this presidency of testing the limits of presidential power.
Yep.
Yes.
Absolutely. And sometimes effectively. I mean, if you look at the use of, which, you know, at the time, I spent a lot of time trying to negotiate USMCA, which is the Mexico-Canada trade agreement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they basically said, no, USMCA is out the window because of fentanyl. So we can impose tariffs because of fentanyl on Mexico and Canada. And almost instantly, the fentanyl trafficking from Mexico dried up. And there's a really good New York Times Daily. There's an embedded reporter down in Mexico who basically confirmed that they were able to do it. So sometimes it's effective. Mm-hmm. Is it the right way? Is it the legal route? I don't know. I mean, to me, using tariffs on it, and by the way, there was very little fentanyl coming through the Canadian border. So that was sort of a red herring, but it was the same trade agreement that they were able to impose new tariffs or threaten to impose new tariffs under. Yeah. So sometimes the flexing works.
Yep.
And I think to some degree the flexing works with the behavior of other countries. When you see what's going on now in Ukraine and the European countries that are now saying we're willing to support Ukraine militarily, which didn't happen until Trump kind of did some, you know, really extreme behavior relative to, you know, trying to assert U.S.
Yeah.
You know, dominance.
And let me also point out that the move to expand or test the limits of presidential authority is not unique to this president.
Oh, no.
This has been going on for a couple of decades now. I mean, look at Obama's I've got a phone and a pen in DACA. Look at Biden's refusal to take the Supreme Court's word as the final word in terms of student debt forgiveness. Some of us have been lamenting this kind of, you know, this imperial authority that presidents have been claiming, not just this one, but in the past. You know, where's Congress in all of this? I mean, some of us keep waiting for Congress to reassert its, you know, to remind people, hey, we have three branches of government here. We're one of them.
I would argue in any government, you need to have at least two different parties with a voice. And I would say that's true in New York. And
two different branches in this instance.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Branches. First off, there should never just be one branch. That's my opinion. Legislature can be bicameral, unicameral. I don't care. But if you don't have basically opposing voices with some degree of power or authority, the tendency to run away with power is not behold. It's not owned by one party. It's human nature.
Yeah, right.
So, I mean, having government that is divided is actually a very, very effective way of keeping things in check. And we don't have that right now.
Yeah.
All right. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and finish up with a couple more segments. And we welcome your letters, as always. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. So last call on the letters. Panel at WAMC.org, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Robert Pendicio, and Heather Mulligan. Here, we'll continue our conversation after these messages and news. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this fifth day of September, 34 minutes past 10 o'clock. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So a couple more issues that I'd like to get to in our 20 minutes or so that we have left. And we will we'll go to those, and if we have any letters on other issues, we can go back to those as well. All right, let's talk about Lisa Cook. This is a story that's been around for a little bit. We talked about it, obviously, during the beginning when she was ousted. But as far as the legal the legal issues and what is going on now, I don't think we have properly discussed. The Justice Department has opened a criminal mortgage fraud investigation of Federal Reserve Board member Lisa Cook. It's a sharp escalation of the Trump administration's efforts to oust her from the central bank's board. Investigators in recent days have issued subpoenas as part of the inquiry, which originated with a criminal referral from Bill Pulte, director of the Federal Housing Finance Agency, according to the two people who spoke on the condition of anonymity. When Pulte has ultimately accused Cook of making false statements on mortgage applications in connection with a home in Michigan and a condominium in Georgia, the probe is being overseen by Ed Martin, the director of the department's Weaponization Working Group. There's another great name.
I know. It's very, very George Orwellian.
Who is also overseeing similar mortgage fraud investigations involving Trump foes referred for investigation by Pulte, such as Senator Adam Schiff of California and New York Attorney General Letitia James. But the Justice Department's move is the latest example of mounting political and legal pressure facing the embattled Federal Reserve governor fighting to keep her job on the central bank's board ahead of its next meeting, which begins on September 16th. If Cook prevails in the short term, she would be able to temporarily remain in her seat, but under a cloud of unresolved allegations that leaves the Fed in an awkward position. Sienna, why don't you lead us off here?
She goes,
no.
Pass.
Or you can just leave it off. That's
just
too.
Just leave it off. I mean, you know, we said this earlier in the program about how we feel about the weaponization of the Department of Justice. I think you brought up a good point about, you know, whether it was done during the Biden administration or not. And what all we ask is, you know, for consistency, mm-hmm. if it is going to be done. Consistency. Mm-hmm. And so it harkens back to, and it's Department of Justice. So in this case, it was the city of New York that brought the charges against Trump and his business allegations. But to me, as someone part of the legal profession, I always valued the Department of Justice taking their time doing measured steps when they decide whether or not to pursue something like this.
Right.
And that was one of our issues in the prior administration with going after Trump for whatever reasons, is that how long it took them to come up to that, how long it took them to determine how much time it took before they made these charges and what they went after and what they did. At the very least, in this situation, I think a special counsel should have been appointed for this situation so it doesn't seem as political. That would have been the proper move to make so that you don't have that politicization of the situation, because it does feel, especially in light of all the things that he said against the Fed, and we know his position and him being Trump, it does feel very pointed and very blatant. And that's my primary concern with it.
Yeah, I so the context, I think, is really interesting and important. A, okay, I kind of do have a problem with someone who's in a position like that, you know, misrepresenting their residency.
Yes,
you know, I mean, I have a mortgage and I have a camp. And when I signed the paperwork, I didn't tell them it was my primary residence.
Yeah.
And I pay a different interest rate, right? And the requirements are different than if it's your primary residence.
Right. And by the way, who sets interest rates? What are they called again?
Right.
Oh, the Federal Reserve.
Right. Which she is a member of, right?
Exactly.
Right. So I'm like, okay, maybe you shouldn't, you know, you should be a little more careful. But if we're going to have the, you know, the purity test.
Yeah. Exactly.
Then it should apply to everyone, yeah. Right? And I can't remember who it was, but there was a, I don't even remember who the president was, but there was a federal, like U.S. government, maybe cabinet level nominee who was forced to withdraw her nomination because she had, like, either a nanny.
Oh, Zoe Baird.
That's who it was. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And right. To me, it was like, right? Like, if you're going to, and it was Secretary of Labor, was it Secretary of Labor? Or it was something relatively high level.
Yeah. Yes.
And it was something that lots of people do, right? They have people who take care of their kids off the books. I mean, it's very common practice, even in D.C. I'm going to just, you know, make a completely no factual foundation here, but I'm going to just guess that there are some members of Congress who have babysitters that they don't do 1099s for, or do, you know, withholding or any of that stuff. Maybe house cleaners or, but.
And we haven't heard about ICE picking any of these people up.
Right.
For
but you know, Zoe Baird had to give up her nomination.
Yeah, because, she was nominated for Attorney General.
Attorney General. And mm-hmm. So they dug this up that she had.
It was a nanny problem, they
yeah,
called it. That
yeah,
was a big thing in the
problem.
90s, a nanny problem.
To me, it seems like very similar.
Yeah.
I mean,
like it's a different set of rules being applied.
Well,
now, but it's okay to have a higher standard if it's relevant to that position,
and
right?
If it's cleaning house, I just want to say really quickly, I'll let you go, is that we saw this during the investigation about when Trump found with the documents in his house.
Oh, the classified materials.
Classified materials,
yeah.
Yes. And what happened next? They went to Obama to see if there was an issue there. They followed on to Biden. Like, I just wanted to see it. I want to see that it's cleaning house. If you're going to clean house, clean house.
Yeah.
Across the board.
Same rules for everybody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Same rules for everybody. That's
yeah.
what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I mean, obviously, it's politically expedient, and it's almost novelistic, right? In other words, you are a governor on the body that sets interest rates, and you are taking advantage of this deal to get a better interest rate. So that shouldn't happen. And if it's true, and it seems like it is, then she should probably resign. She shouldn't be prosecuted. I mean, I think most responsible adults would say, okay, I got to go. I can't serve credibly. Can I raise a different point, however? I'm having some cognitive dissonance over the very idea of the Federal Reserve. And don't get me wrong, I just like the Federal Reserve just fine. But we haven't focused on the issue of whether or not the coverage has been, oh, Trump, you know, should not be able to fire this person. Well, then, what branch of government is the Federal Reserve? Do we have a fourth branch of government?
Right.
It's part of the executive branch, right?
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit confused as to why this is a controversy. I mean, I get that you want to have it independent, but surely we can't have an unaccountable fourth branch, de facto fourth branch of government, right? So I'm struggling with the constitutionality of the Federal Reserve. Has this been a discussion point at all that I've just missed?
You know, that's interesting. I mean, I know that the Reserve Chair has a term, right? And that's why he's still there. And I don't think he really wants Jerome Powell gone anyways, like right away, next year. But but that is very specific. Like, it's a very specific thing that he cannot be removed, right? But there's a congressional process there. I think that they're subject to confirmation by Senate confirmation.
Sure.
I don't know if all the reserve members, and that'd be something that, you know, worth Googling.
But if, I guess restate my question, if the president doesn't have the ability, or if you don't want the president to have the ability to fire a board governor for cause, then who is holding the Federal Reserve accountable?
Fair question. And that's why I was saying if it's a subject to Senate confirmation, then it would be arguably there'd be some
legislative
oversight, you know. But, you know, the problem may be solved based on today's jobs report. So because the jobs report is not good.
So
I think it's likely the Fed is going to cut rates. And it doesn't require unanimity. So even if she would vote against it, I think there's probably enough members there to vote for a rate cut at this point.
Are these numbers from the new?
Today's.
No, I know that.
Oh, yeah.
But are these under the new overseer of the Bureau of Labor Statistics?
Oh. Should we be questioning them? I find it hard to believe they could control the dial that quick, but maybe.
Sorry, just go back to your question because I do have an answer to that. So under the Federal Reserve Act, a governor can be removed from the president for cause.
Right, that's exactly what we're debating
saying,
here.
Right, whether it's for cause, I think that's why it has to be litigated because apparently there's not much case law on it.
Okay.
Regarding
has it ever happened?
I don't believe it has.
Yeah.
I don't believe it has.
It's cause is I don't like you.
For cause, right? Yeah. And she would argue is that she did disclose the discrepancy in the vetting. So she has an argument, but it's already been tainted.
Yeah.
By the news cycle, she's already been tainted, right? And the credibility and of her position, her being there. That's the problem. But it has to be fully tested in the court because the for cause needs to be defined, so to speak, because it hasn't been done before.
Yeah, that's pretty fuzzy, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion as we have our last moments with Santa Freeman Tolbert, Robert Pendicio, and Heather Mulligan for this morning's outing. I do want to mention the U.S. labor markets and the jobs report that came out. Employers added only 22,000 jobs in August, and the unemployment rate rose slightly to 4.3%. Revised data also showed that employment fell by 13,000 jobs in June, the first net loss since December of 2020. And this also, we should note, is that labor markets, yes, stalling this summer, and August data is adding to that slowdown. And the unemployment rate rose slightly, as I mentioned, to 4.3%. The economy has been cooling since its red-hot pandemic peak in the face of high interest rates and has more recently been buffeted by a barrage of tariffs and other disruptive economic policies from the Trump administration. With revisions, the labor market now appears to have lost 13,000 jobs in June, the first negative number since December 2020. In total, numbers for the previous 2 months were revised down by 21,000 jobs.
I'm just checking Indeed.com to see if the job opening for Bureau of Labor Statistics is up yet.
Yes.
Actually, Indeed did flag employment growth over the year to date is the lowest it's been since 2010. Mm-hmm. So this is serious. And there's labor force participation rates are very, very low.
Yeah.
I mean, there's pockets.
They've been low.
But it's 17 million fewer people in the U.S. labor force. And the economy, 17 million fewer people in the U.S. labor force since 2010, which seems insane. Like, where did everyone go? I mean, I guess there's the you know, the baby boomers aging out and retiring, and that's a big blob of people. And they didn't replace, and sort of very scientific, they didn't replace their blob of people with an equally large blob of people. So you do have fewer people who are workforce age.
Permanent disability are through the roof as well. It's not 17 million, obviously.
Yeah,
but that's one of those quiet statistics that doesn't show up in the statistics.
Well, in the workforce stuff that I do nationally, workforce is an issue everywhere, particularly in manufacturing. But since the pandemic, there's been a lot of discussion about, you know, between 1.7 and 2.4 people who just disappeared from the workforce. Primarily men, working age men. And there's a lot of speculation as to what they're doing other than maybe playing video games in their mom's basement. But which is, you know, everyone's.
And I'm not a fan
of
tariffs, Heather, but to the degree to which they incentivize, you know, reshoring industry, it's hard for me not to be sympathetic to that desired outcome for the reasons that you just described.
For that to work, you got to fix immigration.
Well, that's what I was just going to say.
You got to fix immigration.
Part of this labor shortage, labor movement, that's not accounting for, you know, foreign nationals, is that we have a lot of people that were once under temporary protected status and they had authorization to work here in the U.S. All of that has been revoked or is on the way to being revoked. So people are going to lose a lot more of that workforce. It's becoming a lot hard. Individuals that were in court who had work authorization to work while they were in court, all of those court cases are being dismissed. People are being forced to leave via expedited removal. So you are going to continue to see this decrease in the workforce in all of these different markets. It's going to hit us. And I can just speak from my clientele, is that sometimes they individuals that were working pursuant to employment authorizations, or they're concerned about the birthright citizenship, they're concerned about X, Y, and Z, and so they'd rather just move out of the country. We're seeing these flights to Canada and other countries where they seem more quote unquote welcoming.
Self deportation.
Honest question for both of you, because I simply don't know the answer. If you are undocumented, do you show up in labor statistics? Are you counted as part of the workforce?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I mean, undocumented has a very specific meaning.
Okay, I may be using the wrong term.
Right, there's a lot of ways for people who are not citizens to work. There's visiting work visas, there's temporary work visas, there's and then there's the protections that were afforded to, for example, Venezuelans under the Biden administration, which some of my members were excited about because they are having a lot of trouble filling, in particular, like the early morning manufacturing positions, which pay really, really well. But you need to have legal work authorization. And I think, you know, really, Bureau of Labor Statistics numbers probably only reflect people who have some kind of work authorization. Yep. All that being said, you know, there's a lot of, you know, subcultures of, you know, people somehow securing fake documentation or whatever, and they probably are counted, but all of that doesn't solve the problem of workforce. Right, we need higher workforce participation rate. B, we need a lot more immigration. We need people coming in being able to work. We're gonna lose GDP productivity. Yes. Because of not being able to run shifts. I have manufacturers who can't run entire shifts because they don't have enough people. They would be running 24/7, but they can't run the third shift or whatever because they don't have enough people to work on those. And these are really, really good paying jobs. They are not unpleasant jobs. Despite what people think.
That sounds like it's not a workforce participation issue, but a education issue. In other words, you can't find qualified workers.
Well, yes, there's some of that, although there are some that require nothing more than a GED level and training. But no, there's actually physically not enough people applying. You know, I talked to a manufacturer a couple of years ago, and this is definitely still the case. It's not solved. You know, you have a job fair and you have 40 applicants. 3 show up to the interview, and none of them really want the job.
I've
it's because
this.
They're required, you know, to interview for you know, unemployment insurance reasons or whatever. And the benefits are about to go up. They're October 1st. With by the way, a hat tip to Governor Hochul and to, in particular, Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie. When we closed down for the pandemic, the New York ran up $11 billion in debt to the federal government in unemployment insurance. And unemployment insurance, a lot of people don't realize, 100% paid for tax on employers. Yes. It is not state money. But when you run out of the pot of money that you have, you borrow it from the federal government, and then you get to pay it back with interest. New York, as of 3 months ago, still owed almost $8 billion to the federal government.
Wow.
And businesses have already paid $5 billion in additional taxes to try and dig out of this hole. And it's only businesses paying for it. Well, finally, this year, basically, we joined with labor asking the governor and the legislature to put money in to pay back. So they paid it back. We are fully flush now, so we're well positioned if there is a downturn in the economy. But the end result for those people who are unfortunately unemployed is their weekly benefit is going to go from $450 or $500 to $800 a week. So the benefit was frozen because we were in debt. It is now unfrozen, and it is brought back up. So, you know,
more incentive to
if there is a downturn, at least the people who are unemployed are going to be making significantly more money, which
right.
is better for the overall economy, right? Because they spend that money gets spent in grocery stores and rent and that kind of thing. So,
two interesting things about this report. I thought one, while job growth has slowed, employers also haven't been laying people off in large numbers. For those who do find themselves without a job, however, finding another is proving more difficult. The number of people with continued employment claims has been elevated since April. So
yeah.
The people who continually are out there looking, that number has gone up.
Yeah, and there is a mismatch, and there has been for a long time, between the job openings and the people who are out of work. I mean, going back 10, 15 years even, for people who are, you know, high school or lower, there were essentially two people looking for every one job opening. And for anything middle skills, like associate's degree level, it was the complete opposite. It was there are two to three openings per qualified individual looking for a job. So it's a skills gap.
I'm hearing college students saying they have a hard time finding jobs.
Yeah,
well, so I saw some reporting on that.
Well, it depends on. So a lot of it there's a lot of discussion about financial support by degree, because there are some degrees where you're going to have a job, right? If it's a technical degree, welding, I mean, which isn't even that's an associate's degree. They're 100% employed.
Or
right?
It's a certificate. I've actually written about this. In the K-12 education world that I inhabit, we have pushed college for years. And, you know, now that we are taking an interest in CTE, career and technical education, the question that I've raised is, do we have the capacity to train a workforce for a more technically skilled job market of the future? And I'm not sure we do.
Yeah, I mean, definitely K-12 education has not been sufficiently connected
to the workforce. No question.
Yeah. And there are people who cringe at the thought of that. I think that being said, you need to make sure that there's still arts and music and you know, and all of those things too to help people really explore what their options are. But we've been steering people away from the technical workforce for decades, and we're paying the price for it.
Yeah, I mean, the conventional wisdom was there's a wage premium associated with college going, so therefore everyone must go to college. But we allowed our CTE portfolio, as it were, to atrophy, shall we say.
Yeah, and I think there is a time differential. So immediately after graduation, the technical degrees, CTE degrees, tend to be much higher compensated than entry level, say, liberal arts degree related. But if you look out, I think it's somewhere like 10 years or so, they become equal. And then advanced education, higher education, that doesn't apply at all.
And with AI,
your JD, MD.
With AI, I think that gap will get worse.
Yeah.
All right. We are out of time. My thanks to our brilliant panel and for your insights and thoughtfulness this morning. I so appreciate it. I hope you all have a beautiful weekend. Enjoy. Thank you. We will be back with more of the roundtable coming up right after this.